From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The member states and observer states of the SCO are our close neighbors. As we say in China, a close neighbor is better than a distant relative. And our neighbors are as close as family, and we are privileged to be your host.
That was China's Prime Minister Li Keqiang Tuesday as he opened the 14th Shanghai Cooperation Organization Prime Minister's Meeting in Zhengzhou, China, the capital of central China's Henan province. Welcoming the group of assembled foreign leaders, Prime Minister Li said that since it was established in 2001, the SCO has become an important force promoting regional stability, prosperity, and development.
Since its inception 14 years ago, the SCO has traversed an extraordinary journey. We have increased political mutual trust and made important contribution to the well-being of member states and the stability in the region. We have signed the Treaty on Long-Term Good Neighborliness, Friendship and Cooperation, established over 50 cooperation mechanisms at multiple levels in various fields, jointly formulated a multilateral economic and trade cooperation program and an implementation plan, and achieved good progress in cooperation across the board.
On the agenda, deeper cooperation in trade, investment, finance, transportation, security, and culture. The SCO currently has six member states: China, Russia, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Uzbekistan, with Afghanistan, India, Iran, Mongolia, and Pakistan as observers, and Belarus, Turkey, and Sri Lanka as dialogue partners. Another condemnation of U.S. plans for new visa restrictions, this one coming from the U.S.'s closest ally. Press TV's Bardi Ahonardar has more.
Diplomats from the 28-member European Union have warned that they could respond in kind if Washington approves plans to end visa-free entry for some EU nationals. The EU ambassador to the U.S., David O'Sullivan, said such indiscriminate action against more than 13 million European citizens who travel to the U.S. each year would be counterproductive. He said the move could trigger legally mandated reciprocal measures and would do nothing to increase security. Last week, the U.S. House of Representatives voted in support of the Visa Waiver Program Improvement Act of 2015 under the pretext of preventing likely terror attacks. The measure, which is yet to be approved by the Senate, would prevent nationals from 38 countries who have visited Syria, Sudan, Iraq, and Iran in the past 5 years from entering the U.S. without a visa.
Political analyst Alexander Azadgan believes that the U.S. decision to make changes to the program is in line with its general policy of racial and religious profiling.
These are indiscriminate actions against over 13 million EU citizens. You know, as you know, these restrictions are targeting nationals from 38 countries. There seems to be a terrorist hotbed in Belgium, and yet there's no visa restrictions on that country. There's definitely hypocrisy here. There's definitely racial profiling going on here. But you have to keep in mind, we have had racial profiling and religious profiling of all sorts since 2001.
Meanwhile, the EU was set to unveil Tuesday its own controversial proposals for people seeking entry there, a new border and coast guard agency to be charged with curbing the record influx of refugees into the continent. The European Commission said Tuesday that it will propose a new military force consisting of at least 1,500 armed troops aimed at slowing the record flow of nearly 1 million refugees and asylum seekers to Europe this year. According to reports, the planned force will be granted power to intervene even when the host country does not consent. A former U.S. prisoner of war whose release was obtained in a controversial prisoner swap with the Taliban will face court-martial despite the recommendations of the Army's own senior investigators. A top Army commander Monday ordered that 29-year-old Sergeant Bo Bergdahl be tried on charges of desertion and endangering troops stemming from his alleged decision to leave his outpost in 2009, a move that prompted a huge manhunt and landed him in nearly 5 years of Taliban captivity. The decision by General Robert B. Abrams, the head of Army Forces Command at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, means that Sergeant Bergdahl faces a possible life sentence. Bergdahl's defense lawyers said that the Army lawyer who presided over the preliminary hearing in the case had recommended that the sergeant face neither jail time nor a punitive discharge, and that the case be referred to an intermediate tribunal known as a special court-martial, where the most severe penalty possible would be a year of confinement. Bergdahl's freedom was obtained in exchange for the release of five Taliban-affiliated Guantanamo Bay detainees. Republican lawmakers have accused President Obama of circumventing the law by failing to notify Congress before making the exchange, charging that the move was politically motivated and intended to settle his campaign promise to close the infamous prison. RT's Marina Portnaya filed this report.
First, let's cover the allegations of illegality. A report released by the Republican majority on the House Armed Services Committee alleges that the Obama administration broke the law by failing to notify Congress before five Taliban prisoners were transferred from Gitmo to Qatar. So essentially, he didn't even consult with lawmakers. Now, the committee's chairman, Mac Thornberry, insinuated that President Obama proceeded with the secret prisoner swap in order to settle his campaign promise. Now, that promise, of course, refers to his vow to close the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center. Nearly 7 years after signing an executive order to do so, 107 detainees are still languishing there, and dozens have been cleared for release.
I have said repeatedly that I intend to close Guantanamo, and I will follow through on that.
Guantanamo will be closed no later than 1 year from now.
When I was elected in 2008, I said we need to close Guantanamo. I continue to believe that we've got to close Guantanamo.
It's time to close Gitmo.
Now, the White House has repeatedly denied that any laws were violated with the secret prisoner swap, and also denying that there was any ulterior motive. The White House spokesperson says the action of the prisoner swap was carried out based on Obama's belief that a country should make every effort to recover America's POWs. Now, to many, these accusations from Republicans about Obama having an ulterior motive with the prisoner swap, they're not extremely surprising. The majority of Republicans have opposed the president's efforts to close the controversial prison.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is in Moscow, meeting with Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov at the request of the White House. The Syrian conflict and counterterrorism efforts were said to be at the top of the agenda. Kerry spoke at a press conference after his arrival in the Russian capital.
In the meeting in New York between our presidents, both President Putin and President Obama made it very clear that they wanted to try to find a way forward on Syria, and they also wanted to find a way to resolve Ukraine. What is important to note is that even when there have been differences between us, we have been able to work effectively on specific issues. And Russia made a significant contribution to the dialogue on the Iran nuclear agreement. And now, in both of the Vienna discussions, Russia has been a significant contributor to the progress that we've been able to make. More than a contributor, you personally have really been a co-convener. And I thank you for the efforts we've made to lead us up now, hopefully, to getting to New York and building on the progress that's been made. On ISIL or Daesh, Russia and the United States agree that this is a threat to everybody, to every country, that there is no negotiation. These are the worst of terrorists. They attack culture and history and all decency, and they leave no choice but for civilized nations to stand together and to fight and push back. And as President Obama said in New York, nothing would please us more than to resolve the differences of Ukraine and be able to move forward in the economic front and on other areas of important cooperation. Last night I was in Paris meeting with many of our counterparts on the issue of Syria, and it was constructive. They have good ideas about how we can coordinate. And so I look forward this morning to our being able to make real progress. I think the world benefits when powerful nations with a long history with each other have the ability to be able to find the common ground. And today I hope we can find some common ground.
The Secretary of State later met with Russia's President Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin. For more on this and other news, we spoke with analyst Eric Dreitzer via Skype Tuesday. I know you just got back from Venezuela, and you're probably all keyed up to talk about that, but I wanted to ask you about a couple things first. The headlines today, we have the situation with the visas, with the EU basically threatening that the U.S. could be looking at reciprocal requirements for visas in between what now is a visa-free zone, and also the Bergdahl case.
Well, I mean, did you want to cover anything specifically, or just my thoughts generally?
Generally.
Well, as far as the visas issue goes, I think it is interesting as far as the relations between the United States and Europe. On the one hand, it seems that politically speaking, the European space is dominated by the U.S., by NATO, by the, you know, under the thumb of U.S. Hegemony. However, there are obviously political divides, and certainly in the wake of Paris, we have seen a number of these divides, I think, coming to the fore. Obviously, the French government and the U.S. have had a difference of opinion as to how to move forward in Syria. We see Germany moving closer to Russia, in particular with regard to energy deals, the Nord Stream pipeline, which is in many ways a lifeline for the German economy. So there's a number of issues in which Europe is in many ways divided in its loyalties between the United States on one hand and the European direction and Russia and other issues on the other hand. And I think that in many ways, this particular issue is a spillover from that.
You know, you mentioned that pipeline deal. What's the situation inside Germany? You know, we could go back to 1989 with a, you know, at least a pair of factions, one representing the German capital, German industrialists in particular, and finance capital. And on the other hand, this sort of just anti-Russian, anti-Soviet grouping that's primary concerns apparently are U.S. geopolitical concerns vis-a-vis Russia rather than German economic concerns. It seems suddenly that after a long period of the people who are in favor of U.S. policy being dominant, that the power of the economic compulsion of this particular deal is moving in favor of Germany's economy.
Well, certainly, and I think that there are a number of indicators that show that German industrialists, the German capitalist class, is not 100% in line with the German government, which is more or less still aligned with the United States. I think we saw that with the Minsk agreements on the Ukraine issue, where Germany really took the lead in trying as best it could to come to some kind of a political arrangement rather than a continued escalation of conflict with Russia. I think we've seen that again, in terms of the energy deals that Germany has signed with Russia. And I think we saw that also be the case with Greece, where the Germans really took a much harder line with the Syriza government and with the issue of debt haircuts and restructuring and all of the rest of that, versus the United States, which really saw Greece rather than economic issue as more of a political and a geopolitical issue in terms of its interests in countering Russia and China in the European space. And so just on those three particular issues, you see a clear divide between a major swath of the German ruling establishment and the United States, which more or less is still in line with Merkel's government, although even that has been somewhat rocky, especially since the revelations from Edward Snowden that the United States government was surveilling Merkel and tapping her phone and tapping the phones of her aides and so forth. So certainly there are these divides, and I think that it's on the one hand beneficial to notice these divides and to speak about them. On the other hand, I think it's also important not to overstate the distance between Germany and the United States, because ultimately Germany is still militarily essential as far as the U.S.-NATO power projection goes. The air bases in Germany, the U.S. military presence, Germany as a staging ground for U.S. military power projection all throughout Europe and really far beyond Europe, as we saw NATO's war in Libya and elsewhere. So this sort of tension between Germany as U.S. proxy versus Germany as the engine of independent European economic development, I think this tension is something to pay attention to and something that will loom large in the coming years.
Yeah, you know, this is all happening as Kerry is in Moscow meeting with Lavrov, and I think about now probably meeting with Putin. They have a lot on the table. You have what's going on in Ukraine. You have what's going on in Syria. You've had a couple of incidents on the seas between Turkey, NATO member Turkey, and Russia in the past couple of days. And also while Lavrov and Putin are meeting with Kerry, the SCO is meeting in China.
Absolutely. These meetings between Kerry and Lavrov and Kerry and Putin, I think, are really important because the trajectory of the conflict in Syria, I think it's pretty clear now, even to some of the, let's call them more dovish U.S. officials, particularly within the Obama administration, that the policy that the United States has been pursuing has been a failure. In other words, they have not been able to actually achieve regime change. They're not able to really control terrorism in the way that the United States would like to be able to control it, to use it as a weapon for their own ends. And so I think that there is a very real feeling within some key officials in the Obama administration that they do need to find some kind of a political solution. But what the United States is unwilling to do is to drop this pretense of so-called moderate rebels, moderate terrorists. And I think that one of the central objectives for Kerry in the negotiations or in the discussions today with his Russian counterparts is specifically which elements that the United States has been backing, which of these elements are going to be part of a so-called opposition coalition that will take part in negotiations with the Assad government, overseen, of course, by the world's powers. And I think that the United States is pushing hard to maintain some of the what they might call moderate jihadi elements as part of this coalition, while Russia is really unwilling to accept terrorists that it has been fighting against, that it has been seeking to destroy, coming to the negotiating table. I think this is one of the major sticking points. What exactly is the nature of this coalition? And then I think another major sticking point has to do with Assad himself and whether Assad and the duly elected Syrian government will be part of a political negotiation process. The United States maintains steadfastly, as it has for 4 years, that quote-unquote Assad must go, while Russia maintains steadfastly, as it has for 4 years, that only the Syrian people can decide what government will represent them. And so I think that this divide is also something that's going to need to be bridged if they're going to be able to come back to the negotiating table supposedly on Friday and push towards that claimed January 1st ceasefire deadline. I don't know whether that will be achieved, but certainly it's in the interests of the United States to go towards that direction if they're interested in peace, although I think that's somewhat dubious. And Russia, which does not want an open-ended military intervention in Syria either. So there are overlapping interests, I think, that need to be paid attention to, and certainly those are the developments that we need to follow in the coming days.
And everyone is kind of positioning around this, too. You've got the list of who's a terrorist and who's an acceptable partner / legitimate opposition being compiled by Jordan, apparently, with the in my opinion, as the agent of the U.S. But the Russians had met with and, you know, reached agreement with Jordan also at the head end of that. And now Saudi Arabia announcing it's got 937 allies in a new fight against terrorism. I don't remember what the number is, 48 or something, putting together a group that is apparently going to interject itself as a group into this discussion. They're all getting, you know, sort of circling the table as Lavrov and Kerry are hashing out the details.
Well, there's no doubt, and I think that what this demonstrates a number of things. I think, first and foremost, the clout and the influence that the Saudis have with the extremist elements on the ground in Syria, this is just yet more confirmation of what you and I and many others have been talking about for a long, long time now, namely the pivotal and central role that Saudi Arabia has played in organizing, financing, orchestrating the war in Syria. And the fact that the Saudis can really be that catalyst that coalesces these groups into some kind of a cohesive coalition, I think that's quite telling of just how central of a role Saudi Arabia has played. And certainly this is no secret. Now, the question, I think, has to be, what will Russia be willing to accept in terms of the nature of this coalition? I don't think that it is politically palatable for the Russians to be bombing groups that they will then have to negotiate with at the table as if they were equals with the Syrian government. So this question about whether or not Saudi Arabia is going to be a deciding factor in the construction of this coalition, I think it's really important, because certainly even the Russians understand the importance of opening up a dialogue, and not just a dialogue for the sake of a dialogue, but a real dialogue moving towards some kind of a solution, temporary though it may be. I think that this is critical, and certainly the changing face of the fight on the ground in Syria is one of the driving forces behind this. If it were not for the Russian involvement there in support of the Syrian Arab Army, Hezbollah, and the other forces on the ground, if it were not for that intervention, there is no doubt that the United States and its allies would continue pushing for the regime change, continue destroying the country as best they could. Now, I want to temper any positive feelings about what might happen in the near future with this point, that the neocon establishment in Washington, which is in many ways opposed to Obama, at least rhetorically, if not ideologically, that neocon establishment is reasserting itself within the policy circles. We saw, of course, famously a few months ago, David Petraeus arguing for arming the al-Nusra Front. That question is very much lurking behind the scenes with regard to what this opposition coalition is going to look like. We also saw John Bolton writing in the pages of the New York Times that the United States needs to push strongly for the creation of a legitimate Sunni state carved out of Iraq and Syria, a Sunni state presumably which would be under the control of ISIS, the Islamic State. So this tension within Washington, I think, translates into a larger geopolitical tension. And so the Russians have to be looking at Washington with a skeptical eye, wondering whether they're actually going to be engaging in substantive negotiations in a genuine way, or whether Washington is being duplicitous and utterly disingenuous in terms of what its real objectives are for the region.
So I want to get into Venezuela with you a little bit, but before we do that, I just want to stop, and we won't touch on Bergdahl's case. I'd rather talk about the SCO. You have six members of the SCO, six full members, five of them Soviet republics, Russia, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Uzbekistan, and China, and then Afghanistan, India, Iran, Mongolia, Pakistan.
No, it was Kyrgyzstan, not Kurdistan.
Oh, Kyrgyzstan, I said. Yeah, Kyrgyzstan.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
That's my pronunciation. Now you've got Afghanistan, India, Iran, Mongolia, Pakistan, Belarus, Turkey, and Sri Lanka as either dialogue partners or observers. You know, that's a very key piece of real estate there. And this is, you know, the agenda items that China's Prime Minister, Li Keqiang, laid out this morning when he introduced it, had to do, starting with, the first item he listed was regional stability, prosperity and development, trade, investment, finance, transportation, security, and culture. You know, what do you see happening in terms of developments among those countries and in Asia generally in this big game that we're describing?
Well, it certainly is a big game. Dare we say a great game, as, of course, Central Asia was the battleground for the original great game between the Russian Empire and the British Empire in the 19th century. And certainly it remains a very important focal point, a battleground between the competing power blocks in the world today. And I think that we need to understand it within the broadest context possible. It's not just the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which, of course, boasts a huge portion of the world's population, including Russia, China, India, Pakistan, many other countries as well. In the region, of course, that makes up a huge portion of the world. But we need to understand it against the backdrop of the other multilateral initiatives and development processes happening, including the establishment, of course, as we know, the BRICS and the BRICS Development Bank, including the Eurasian Economic Union formed by Russia and some of its former Soviet partners, including, and this is probably the big one here, especially for China, the One Belt, One Road strategy, or the New Silk Road, including all of the corollaries, the Maritime Silk Road, the Land-Based Silk Road, and others. This initiative from China, which really brings China into a tangible and cohesive unit with the rest of Asia and with Europe, the entire Eurasian landmass. This is the great project for China, the so-called Chinese Dream, the integration of China as a focal point for the entire global economy. And in many ways, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is to some extent the political arm of this new multilateral development process. Now, when the SCO was originally founded, we were thinking in terms of counterterrorism. We were thinking in terms of shared domestic and international security issues. And certainly the Shanghai Cooperation Organization has focused on that, including things like terrorism in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, including the issues in Xinjiang province in western China, including a number of other really important issues such as drug trafficking, migration, and all of these sorts of issues. But increasingly, the SCO has now also become a forum for military cooperation and economic cooperation. And the confluence of these seemingly divergent but really interrelated streams, I think that confluence is absolutely critical to understanding the entire development process happening in the region. Look, you have Russia and China moving closer together economically. Russia building at least two major pipeline projects to bring Russian energy into China in the coming decades. You have China moving closer to towards its establishing a sphere of influence in the South China Sea. On the other hand, you have China being encircled by the U.S. with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. There are a number of very complicated and interrelated geopolitical and strategic forces happening here that make the SCO a central issue for the entire development of Eurasia. And it's becoming, it seems like every year when the SCO meets, it increases in its importance. Now Iran is going to be a full member of the SCO, if not this year, then next year most likely. Iran and India and Pakistan moving towards full member status. I believe they're having that in 2016. So all of this tells you that the world has shifted dramatically. A lot of these countries, even ones like India, for example, which is in many ways aligned with the United States in terms of its foreign policy, particularly as far as its anti-China posture goes, even India recognizes the importance of integration in the Eurasian space, that it cannot be left behind. behind by the course of development of the 21st century. And I think that Europe and the United States in many ways are fearful of these development processes. And certainly that's why the United States is pushing so hard in the South China Sea. That's why the United States is pushing so hard with the Trans-Pacific Partnership and with ASEAN and with all of the other initiatives that the U.S. can control. Increasingly, Eurasia is moving out of the U.S. Orbit, out of U.S. hegemony, and so Washington is pushing back in as many ways as it can.
Okay, Eric Dreitzer, thanks a lot for your time. The pleasure as always.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.